Silence comes over the room, so it must be time to start. Welcome to the Barbara Jordan Conference Center and to the Kaiser Family Foundation to this briefing on our next 50-state survey, the findings on Medicaid and CHIP eligibility and enrollment policies. I'm Diane Rowland, the Executive Vice President of the Kaiser Family Foundation and the Executive Director of the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured, and I'm very delighted to have you all here today to once again revisit where the states are and provide insight into their eligibility levels, their enrollment processes, and their cost-sharing policies. This is our 11th annual survey, so that we have quite a baseline for being able to follow what the states have been doing with their eligibility and enrollment over the years, to see the progress that has been made in terms of simplification of the eligibility systems and standardization of some of the eligibility levels. But I think today's survey is particularly important because it's also a baseline for the implementation of health care reform in 2014, and it shows some of the progress that many of the states are making to try to move forward with new technology and new eligibility rules as they prepare for the implementation of health care reform. It's also great to do this because with all 50 states participating, we're really able to get away from the anecdotes of one state at a time and be able to really look at how the country is proceeding with implementing many of the changes in eligibility that underscore the move toward health care reform. We also, of course, want to really thank the states. This is not easy to get 50 states to all participate in a survey to give you the kind of feedback we have, and we appreciate with their budget constraints and with the time constraints they have that they're able to provide us not only with this survey, but with the many other times we turn to them for budget information and other information. Today, we're going to be actually releasing two different reports. The first, and most significant in terms of being able to provide you with data on all 50 states is our survey of eligibility, enrollment, renewal, and cost-sharing policies in Medicaid and CHIP. This represents new 2012 data and identifies policy changes that occurred during 2011. We conduct this survey with Georgetown University Center for Children and Families and thank them for their cooperation and for working with us. And Martha Heberlein, Tricia Brooks, and Jocelyn Geyer, they are our primary authors, joining with our Kaiser authors, Samantha Artiga and Jessica Stevens. And we do really, again, thank all of the state officials that allow us to make this a 50-state survey. But the second piece that we're releasing today, we call Secrets to Success. It's an analysis of four states who were at the forefront of the nation's gains in children's health care coverage. And it's a policy brief that looks at Alabama, Iowa, Massachusetts, and Oregon, and looks at the kinds of things they've done to achieve some of their success in enrolling eligible children. Again, we did that study in conjunction with Georgetown, Jocelyn Geyer, Tricia Brooks, and Samantha Artiga from Kaiser. We're all participants. We also include in your briefing packet a report that we recently released on ways to begin to look at performance measures under healthcare reform for eligibility and enrollment systems, and we hope that that'll be informative in the work that you have going forward. But today we're going to turn first to try and lay out for you the findings from our 50-state survey and some of the insights from the success stories, and then turn to a very distinguished panel. So I'm going to start with Samantha Artiga and Tricia Brooks to lay out the study findings, and then turn to a distinguished panel with federal, state, and advocate perspectives. We'll start with Cindy Mann, who all of you know as the Deputy Administrator and Director of the Center for Medicaid CHIP and Survey and Certification at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Then John Supra has joined us from the state of South Carolina, where he serves as the Chief Information Officer and Deputy Director for Eligibility and Beneficiary Services in the South Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. And then Deanne Leal, who is the Children and Health Policy and Outreach Manager for Healthcare All for All in Massachusetts. So we'll get a insight into the findings from the study, and then we'll talk a little bit about some of the implications and where we go. So I'm going to turn to Samantha to kick off our discussion and share with you some of our findings. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us here today. I want to follow on a couple of Diane's comments and just again recognize all the study authors. Every single one of them made a huge contribution to the survey, and it truly is a team effort that would not be possible without every person's contributions, as well as wanted to recognize the assistance of Tara Mancini at Georgetown University, who provided a lot of help with the effort as well. And to reiterate Diane's appreciation to the state officials who participated in the survey and took time out of incredibly busy schedules this year to share information with us and help us understand the nuances of their programs. So what I want to do today is really highlight some key overall findings from the survey and then dig in with a little more details on the findings related to eligibility policies. And then I'm going to turn it over to Tricia to pick up on some more detailed findings related to enrollment and renewal procedures and the growing use of technology among the states. But let's start with a few more details about the survey itself. As Diane mentioned, this is the 11th annual survey, which covers all 50 states and the District of Columbia. It's based on telephone interviews that are conducted with Medicaid and CHIP program administrators. And the survey questionnaire covers Medicaid and CHIP eligibility, enrollment, renewal, and cost-sharing policies for children, pregnant women, parents, and other non-disabled adults. As was the case during 2010, during this year's survey, we continued to track state adoption of options that were newly provided by the Children's Health Insurance Program Reauthorization Act in 2009, as well as some early steps related to state implementation of the Affordable Care Act. And as Diane mentioned, all the data you will see here today presents policies in effect as of January 1st, 2012, as well as changes that occurred during the 2011 calendar year. So before we jump into the survey findings, I thought it would be helpful to provide some context about the environment in which states were making their policy choices during 2011. And there are a number of key factors I wanted to highlight. And the first is that both families and states continued to deal with economic pressures during the year. Families continued to have a high need for coverage as job recovery remains slow. Similarly, states continued to face revenue challenges. In addition, midway through the year, the enhanced federal funds that had been provided to states under the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act expired, and those enhanced funds had helped states through the worst of the recession in dealing with increased need for coverage at a time of decreased revenues. And although the expiration of those funds was anticipated, states still found it challenging because they were continuing to face budget shortfalls. Also during the year, the ACA requirement for states to maintain coverage remained in place. Under this requirement, states must hold their eligibility, enrollment, and renewal policies steady at the levels that, at least at the levels that they were at the time the ACA was enacted. And this policy was really designed to preserve the base of Medicaid and CHIP coverage in advance of the coverage expansions that will occur under reform in 2014. As I mentioned, new options and incentives that were provided under CHIPRA continued to shape state activity in 2011. And particularly of note in this last year was that CMS made a new time-limited opportunity available for states to receive enhanced federal funding for major upgrades to their Medicaid eligibility systems. Specifically, states can now receive a 90% federal match as opposed to the typical 50% administrative match for the design, development, and implementation of major upgrades to their systems or new systems. And then lastly, the 2014 implementation date for the coverage expansions, as well as really the overall new coordinated enrollment system for Medicaid and CHIP and exchange coverage drew 1 year closer. So then jumping into the key survey findings, there are really a few key takeaway messages that I think we can get from this slide here. And the first is that, reflective of the ACA requirement for states to maintain coverage, Medicaid and CHIP eligibility had held steady in nearly all states during the year. Second is that even amid the state budget pressures that states were dealing with throughout the year, 29 states made program improvements. And as you'll hear from Tricia, many of these improvements focused on using technology to help increase program efficiency. And you'll also hear from her about the significant impact the new enhanced federal funding has had on state activities to upgrade their Medicaid eligibility systems. And the last point I would make from here is that even though they had the flexibility to do so, few states increased cost-sharing requirements for families during the year. So then, digging in a little bit deeper on eligibility findings, what you see here is that overall, 11 states made targeted expansions in eligibility during the year. Most of these expansions focused on children, and those changes included an expansion in income eligibility for children in West Virginia from 250 to 300% of the poverty level, as well as three states taking up the option provided under CHIPRA to extend coverage to lawfully residing immigrant children without a five-year waiting period, and five states taking advantage of new flexibility provided by the ACA to extend coverage to eligible dependent children of state employees in their separate CHIP programs. In addition to those actions for children, three states also took steps to bolster coverage for low-income adults through their Medicaid programs. This included Washington and New Jersey receiving Section 1115 waivers that allowed them to begin receiving federal Medicaid funds to cover low-income adults they had previously covered with state-only dollars. And Minnesota did the same through a combination of using the new ACA option available to cover low-income adults as well as a Section 1115 waiver. You will see that two states did make eligibility reductions, and these were done under limited exceptions to the ACA requirement for expiring waivers. And specifically, Arizona closed enrollment for childless adults, and Nevada allowed a waiver that covered about 150 pregnant women and a handful of parents to expire during the year. So with those changes, what do we see with regard to children's coverage? And I think what this map shows you is that Medicaid and CHIP across the nation remain a key source of coverage for low-income children. All but four states now cover children in families with income to at least 200% of the federal poverty level, and about half are covering at or above 250% of poverty. And this broad availability of Medicaid and CHIP coverage over the recent years has really protected children's coverage during the recession. And in fact, the uninsured rate for children has fallen in recent years, even as child poverty rates have declined. So as you can see here, eligibility levels remain strong pretty much nationwide for kids. However, the picture is much different for low-income adults. As you see here, their eligibility levels continue to lag far behind that of children. And with regard specifically to parents, you see that eligibility levels for Medicaid remain very low in most states. 33 states cover parents, limit eligibility for parents to below the federal poverty level, and in 17 states they limit eligibility to less than half the poverty level, which is about $9,000 for a family of three during the year. Coverage of other non-disabled low-income adults is even more limited. And what you see here is only eight states provide Medicaid benefits to these adults. Additional states provide coverage that is more limited to these adults, but in many states, low-income adults are not eligible for any coverage regardless of their income level. So overall, I think what these eligibility findings tell you is that states have made significant strides in covering children. However, coverage options for low-income adults remain very limited today. And given that, the Medicaid expansion that will occur in 2014 to extend Medicaid to nearly all individuals up to 133% of poverty will significantly increase coverage options for these adults, many of whom currently lack access to private coverage and remain ineligible for Medicaid today. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Tricia to dig in on the enrollment and renewal findings.
Good morning, everyone. So as I guess I need to, you did advance it, thanks. As Sam mentioned earlier, of the 29 states making improvements, 25 simplified their enrollment or renewal procedures. For the second year in a row, the most popular simplification was documenting citizenship through an electronic data match with the Social Security Administration. 13 additional states implemented this streamlined way to more efficiently and accurately document citizenship for those that it is required for in Medicaid. 8 states added new ways for families to renew coverage that don't rely on the old-fashioned paperwork process of mailing a blank form to them and asking them to fill it out and mail it back in with proof of eligibility. 6 states adopted or expanded their use of express lane eligibility, and 5 states added different functionality to their online services, such as accepting electronic signatures or allowing online renewals. We'll take a closer look at those actions in the next few slides, but it's worth pointing out that some of the states that made changes made multiple changes, and in particular, we highlight the activities of Georgia, Colorado, and South Carolina on page 13 of the report, who moved forward on multiple fronts. To a significant extent, the new options and incentives that were introduced 3 years ago under CHIPRA continue to shape state activities in 2011. Since that Social Security Administration match for citizenship went live, 44 states have adopted it, and that's greatly reduced the paperwork burden on both families and states alike. And while some states start with a single program or population, generally states are extending its use to all Medicaid and CHIP applicants who are subject to the citizenship documentation requirements. And now a total of 9 states have implemented Express Lane eligibility, SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, and State Revenue or Tax Department are the most prevalent ELE agencies, although a couple of states are exploring how to work with their diverse school lunch programs that tend to be administered under different authorities within a state. In 2011, Georgia also launched the first partnership for Express Lane eligibility with WIC. Nearly half of the states now tap federal match to cover lawfully residing immigrant children. Sam noted the new states picking up the option this year, but now we have a total of almost half of the states covering lawfully residing immigrant children and 18 states doing so for pregnant women. While some of these states actually leveraged federal funds to cover what individuals that had been previously covered with state-only funds, this really helps to secure that funding stream, which is really more vulnerable to budget cuts during down economic times. And not noted on this slide, but a key provision in CHIPRA that has contributed to states' improvement activities is the potential to earn Medicaid performance bonuses. The progression of states earning bonuses from 10 in 2009 to 16 in 2010 to 23 this past year is real evidence that the performance bonus has motivated states to introduce new simplifications in their enrollment and renewal processes. This year, almost $300 million was shared by those 23 states, and they received bonuses ranging from $1.3 to $28.3 million. There's ample study that shows that churning of eligible individuals off and back on Medicaid and CHIP is administratively inefficient, since a large percentage of individuals who lose coverage reapply within a matter of weeks or months. Churning also results in gaps in coverage that disrupt continuity of care and make it difficult to measure quality. To address this problem, states have been actively working to reduce churn by simplifying and expanding the options for families to renew coverage. So alternatives to the old-fashioned paperwork method include the use of Express Lane eligibility, telephone renewals, online renewals, and administrative renewals. Administrative renewals are where states use a pre-populated form to send out to the family, and if there are no changes, either requires no action on the part of the family to maintain coverage, or at most requires the family to confirm that they want to continue coverage, and that often happens with a phone call. As you can see from this slide, with the exception of Express Lane eligibility, roughly 40% of Medicaid programs and nearly half of CHIP programs offer each of these alternative renewal methods. But when you look at the bigger picture, what you'll find is that the majority of Medicaid and CHIP programs offer at least one additional method to the old paperwork method, and while a handful of them actually offer three. The longstanding leader in retention, Louisiana, provides four different paths to renewal for Medicaid. While many of the simplification measures are often introduced for children first, over time states have aligned these procedures for parents in Medicaid, with one big exception that you can see here, and that's the asset test. About half of the states continue to consider a family's assets in determining eligibility for parents, while most have eliminated the asset test for children. By 2014, all states will align these measures when access tests and face-to-face interviews are eliminated, and 12-month renewal periods and administrative verification of income will be the standard. However, there may still be some inconsistencies, as not all policies available for children are options for parents. For example, neither 12-month continuous eligibility or Express Lane eligibility are options currently available to parents. However, we are beginning to see states seek waiver authority to more fully align such policies. In 2010, New York received a waiver approval to provide 12-month continuous eligibility to adults, although implementation is pending system changes. And very recently, Massachusetts received waiver approval to use Express Lane eligibility for renewals for parents, which will be implemented as a family-based renewal process through SNAP when the state's children's state plan amendment for Express Lane is approved. As Sam noted, states are advancing their use of technology and web-based services. 2/3 of the state Medicaid programs and 80% of CHIP programs offer online applications that can be submitted electronically. A few of those, however, still require families to sign and mail a piece of paper rather than accept electronic signatures. Most do use that application data to automatically populate or import into their eligibility systems, although a handful continue to manually enter it. And a large majority of the online applications do allow applicants to start, stop, and return to the application to complete it. And about 2/3 go a step further and provide a different additional functionality. They can accomplish other tasks such as checking their benefits, reporting changes, or renewing coverage. These online functions, along with verification of eligibility through trusted electronic data sources, moves us closer to the vision for 2014, when enrollment and renewal will be streamlined and largely paperless, and eligibility is determined in real time. We note in the report that Oklahoma is the first state to operate such a system, with 90% of the more than 1,000 applications processed each day receiving an immediate eligibility response, even when state offices are closed. And that gives us real hope that we can get there in 2014. States are making progress in harnessing technology, but the pace and scope of these efforts really must be accelerated if states are going to be ready in 2014. However, given ongoing state budget challenges, states have really lacked the resources to move forward toward this vision of a fully automated paperless system. To help states prepare, CMS approved the 90-10 rule that Samantha described earlier in April of 2011, and it provides much welcomed relief to states to move forward. There was little doubt that the enhanced funding would be a catalyst for state action, but it was striking to discover in this year's survey just how quickly a diverse majority of states across the country have jumped at the enhanced funding opportunity to make sweeping changes to their Medicaid eligibility systems, many of which are decades old. States clearly understand that this is a time-limited opportunity to help them prepare for 2014. 3 out of every 5 states either have received approval or have submitted the advanced planning documents needed to get approved for the 90-10 funding. And all but 3 states indicate they are planning to move in that direction in 2012. With those highlights of the data, let me summarize the overall key findings of the survey. Given the ACA's protection of Medicaid and CHIP, this report tells a much different story than at the end of the last recession in 2004, when this survey showed that 23 states made it more difficult to secure and retain coverage for children and families. So while we expected states to maintain coverage, it was surprising to see that 29 states went beyond holding steady to make improvements through targeted expansions and streamlining their operations. Our nation's gains in children's coverage, that is, achieving coverage for a record high of 92% of our children, is largely due to the strength of Medicaid, of our Medicaid and CHIP programs. Unfortunately, coverage for parents and adults continues to lag far behind children, while their uninsured rate continues to climb. As Sam noted, although states did have flexibility to impose additional cost sharing on families, not premiums, which are generally protected under the ACA, only six states increased copayments, while four states actually decreased them. And as discussed in a lot more detail, half of the states have simplified how they handle their enrollments and renewals, often using technology to streamline and automate processes. The big news still is the large majority of states that have been approved or are seeking the 90-10 funding to transform their Medicaid eligibility systems. With only three exceptions, states will be busily working in 2012 to revolutionize eligibility using 21st century technology in ways that will make government work better and transform the experience of how families apply for and renew coverage. As budget pressures persist for states, modernizing how they manage enrollment and eligibility has helped them stretch scarce administrative resources. And the ACA builds on their proven strategies, the strategies they've pioneered over years, while providing them with additional resources and clear timelines for implementation. Considering that many of the state innovations in enrollment and renewal procedures were first implemented for children, we wanted to delve into what other factors contribute to our historic success in covering children. So in this separate report, The Secrets of Success, we looked at the experience of four states at the forefront of our nation's gains in coverage. We decided to focus on one state in each region. In the Northeast, the choice was easy. Massachusetts is the clear national leader in children's coverage with 99.5% of children covered. The other states were selected from a number from all of the states that have made strong gains, so we can't actually say that the selection was to identify the best per se. We examined recent gains in coverage and the adoption of enrollment and renewal simplifications and ultimately selected Alabama from the South, Iowa from the Midwest, and Oregon from the West. And although these states have distinct policy and political environments, there really are common elements of success. These include having political leaders who prioritize children's health coverage, expanding and maximizing those eligibility levels. Each of these states cover kids up to 300% of poverty. Adopting a broad range of simplifications, engaging providers and community partners in outreach, application assistance, and program monitoring, ensuring strong coordination between Medicaid and the state's separate CHIP programs. And another common theme is that each of these states continue to address issues and look for ongoing ways to improve their programs, and they share some common challenges in this regard. Being able to manage higher caseloads with diminishing administrative resources, finding ways to reduce churning and improve retention, working with those outdated and flexible eligibility systems that, among other challenges, make it difficult to improve client notices and to produce the timely performance data to identify problems and assess the effectiveness of changes. And last but not least, the challenge of making further progress through administrative and cultural changes while preparing for reform. So in closing, I also want to thank my co-authors, and in particular, recognize the state officials who really do spend an enormous an extraordinary amount of time with us getting the details right. I can't tell you how often we go back and say, can we ask this just a different way. These are really challenging times for state Medicaid and CHIP agencies, and we do appreciate their commitment to improving the health of our nation's children, families, seniors, and people with disabilities. With that, I'll turn it back to Diane.
Thank you, Trish, and thank you, Samantha. And now we'll turn to Cindy to offer some perspectives.
Great. Thank you. It's great to be here this morning. So much better than what my usual mornings are, so I appreciate it. So I just want to recognize my fellow panelists first, Diane Leal from Healthcare for All Massachusetts, the nearly 100% participation rate of eligible children in Massachusetts is in no small part due to the efforts of Diane and Healthcare for All. So I'm eager to hear more about what she has to say. She's still always worried about getting that extra 0.5%, so we love her for that. John Super and his colleagues in South Carolina also deserve a really special call out. South Carolina was one of the states this year that got was a first-time earner of the performance bonus that Tricia spoke about earlier today, and has just adopted express lane eligibility that we've heard a little bit about. Congratulations to John, and we're eager to hear more about what they're up to in South Carolina. Much thanks, of course, goes to the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured and the Georgetown Center for Children and Families for doing this really invaluable survey. As Diane says, having 11 years of this survey provides us with just invaluable information of the trends of how we've been doing in coverage as a nation over the last decade. And beyond that, each year the survey gets a little bit richer and provides a little bit more information in a different area. So we're always learning more as we go forward. So we really want to thank you both for the very detailed survey and the enormous contribution that it makes to our body of knowledge. We're, of course, all very excited to see this year's survey's results indicate that states have maintained or even expanded improved coverage for kids and for families despite some very significant challenges. I think there's little doubt, and if you look at the survey for the last 11 years, it just confirms that certainly coverage is a national priority, and without doubt, the issue of children's coverage is a shared priority across the nation, regardless of political climate, regardless of fiscal challenges. And Samantha, if you want to put up the slide, and you know, here's why. So this is Marilyn, who's 12 years old, her sister Nancy, who's 4 years old, and they live with their mom, Carmen, in Iowa. We've heard a bit about Iowa. They moved from California. They moved to Iowa to work with Carmen's fiance's family, who has a budding bakery business. I practice that. And like many people working in small businesses, they work hard and they don't have health insurance. So Nancy needed dental work, went to the local Department of Health. There's a maternal and child health clinic. Dental hygienist was working with the family and learned that they were uninsured and said, we've got a program for you, and we've even got presumptive eligibility, which means that the family, the children, could get enrolled in coverage at the clinic that day. And that's what presumptive eligibility does. It allows for families to get on coverage if they appear to be eligible at a community-based site that's been certified by the state, and then they can get their coverage quickly and efficiently. And I am told, can't quite see the red, but I'm told that Marilyn's red glasses are a product of finally having coverage and finally being able to get a vision care test, which she hadn't had for too many years. So she got new glasses, and they're spiffy red. So that's really what it's all about. That's really why we all work on these issues and why we care so much about moving forward. Making sure that every child who's eligible for Medicaid and CHIP is actually enrolled in the program is a real top priority of this administration and of Secretary Sebelius and, of course, as we see, of the states. The Secretary has traveled around the country and issued to governors, to community-based organizations, to mayors, to faith-based organizations, and certainly to those of us in the department, that we shall have a challenge to cover every single one of those eligible children and make sure that they're enrolled, and it is formally called the Connecting Kids to Coverage Challenge. And the challenge has not stopped at the doorsteps of HHS. Last August, we involved Secretary Duncan, and together the two secretaries wrote all the superintendents of schools across the country to talk about the ways in which schools and Medicaid programs and CHIP programs and community-based organizations can partner together to make sure that all eligible children are enrolled and stay enrolled. The work is also embedded deep in America's communities. Just last August also, we released $40 million in CHIPRA Outreach Fund grants to dedicated efforts to find, enroll, and retain kids in Medicaid and CHIP. And apropos Tricia's comments, in this year we prioritized a number of areas, one around school-based areas, but also around technology, really trying to invest in technology and see about ways to modernize our systems of outreach, enrollment, and retention. The grants were given to 20 organizations in 23 states, and it follows grants that we issued in 2009 that were provided to 68 grantees in 41 states. And I will say every one of the states represented in the Secrets to Success reports have grantees in their states, and in one case the state itself is a grantee. So we like to see that these grants are really making a difference in people's lives. And just last November, under the banner of the Secretary's Challenge, we had our grantees and some of their closest friends, about nearly 500 people altogether, met in Chicago to talk about lessons learned over the last decade or so in terms of improving coverage and sharing ideas, sharing strategies, and most excitedly, making plans for continuing to move forward. So state progress in this area, which is so well documented in these reports, is also demonstrated by the performance bonuses that we announced at the very end of 2010. As Tricia noted, we announced 23 states had earned bonuses this year, up from 16 states last year, up from 10 states in the first year, 2009, when the bonuses were awarded. And as I've mentioned, South Carolina is one of those states that were awarded a bonus. The bonuses, the annual bonuses, really demonstrate substantial gains in Medicaid enrollment. It's not just because a state has done this program feature or that program feature and has adopted certain changes. They have to adopt those changes as a prerequisite, but they also have to actually boost enrollment of Medicaid children, of the lowest income children. And it is only when they do both, adopt the simplification measures, and actually are successful in achieving significant enrollment gains, that they earn the bonus. One of the most heartening things, beyond the fact that we keep seeing more states qualify for bonuses over the years, is that we see states that have qualified for a bonus continue to improve their programs. And we see that documented in our analysis of the performance bonus quality features, and we certainly see that documented in the report that we have today. The bonuses acknowledges not only the good work, but it really also helps to diffuse the practices over the country. And we like to think of these simplification steps as the gift that keeps on giving, because it doesn't just affect enrollment the year that the state gets the bonus, but week after week, year after year, these simplification measures continue to help families like the Lopez family be able to access coverage. So let me conclude by making two points. First, following the leadership of Secretary Sebelius and certainly the President, who signed the CHIPRA law, one of his first acts coming into office, CMS is really here as a resource to states and others wrestling with these challenges and trying to get to find new ways to improve their systems. There are tried and true methods that we've seen over the years continue to work as states adopt them and perfect them for their local circumstances. There are also new ways of doing things, and as Tricia mentioned, we've provided waivers to New York, waiver authority to New York and Massachusetts to take some of the simplification measures that are statutory options for children and apply those on a family-based way, both continuous eligibility and express lane. Second, I want to note that the kind of progress that have been chronicled for kids over the years through these Kaiser surveys provide us a roadmap for successful implementation in 2014. I would refer you back to looking at Samantha's slides 6 and 7. they show in 2011, 17 states, in 17 states, a parent with earnings just at 50% of the poverty line, which is $9,265 a year, or just a little over $800 a month for a family of three. That parent earns too much to qualify for Medicaid. That will change in 2014, as will the fact that other adults, those whose children have grown and left the home, those who don't have children, any adult who's not otherwise disabled, pregnant, or elderly, those adults can't qualify for Medicaid in more than half the states, no matter what their income level is. That, again, will change in 2014. But as we've learned from the states that have been leading the way, the coverage expansions alone aren't sufficient. So we need to simplify the processes. We need to coordinate the system across programs, and we'll have even more options of in terms of programs available, of course, in 2014. We need to really focus on technology and modernization, and of course, good old-fashioned outreach, making sure people know the opportunities that are available. So we hope to take many of these important lessons that are learned from the state efforts in children's coverage to lay the groundwork for 2014, and really thank the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and Georgetown Center for Children and Family for all your help in providing us this guidance.
Thank you, Cindy. John.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here and to share some of the experiences in South Carolina. Like Cindy, I really do want to thank the Kaiser Foundation, the Georgetown Center on Children and Families for their work that really sets the groundwork so that we can measure the progress that we're making. For us in South Carolina, it is really an exciting time to be active in improving the coverage and access to care for children and their families in South Carolina. And I really have to look at the secrets of success. One of those key elements that was talked about is a real strong support at legislative levels for coverage for kids. And I think for myself, very fortunate to step into an environment where the legislature had recently expanded the coverage limit, and also directed us to use technology or other tools that might be available to ensure that coverage. And I think those two things that are really a statewide initiative set the groundwork for both our new director, Tony Keck, as well as myself coming in and saying, where are we and what progress has been made? And in March, we looked at what simplifications had already been done, what was available, and knowing the pending deadline of April 1st, what could we do? And I think one of the things that our administration in Health and Human Services is very focused on is how do we look at process improvement, the use of technology, and measurement-driven decision-making. And I think in Tricia's portion of the presentation, she talked a lot about what have they seen across the states. And I think many of those things are what we looked at pretty quickly in March to say we'd already met four of the criteria, what available criteria was left that we could reasonably make, and what is the data around that to make a decision. So looking at the goals or the incentives of the bonus program, we asked the question of what do we know? Well, what we found out is, and I think what many states have found out, in our children, we had a tremendous churn. We had about 140,000 kids churning out of the program every single year. 90,000 of those returned to our programs within the year, and 60,000 of them returned to our programs within 1 month. The average time out of our programs were about 1.5 or 1.4 months. What did that say to us? What we were really doing is creating an awful lot of administrative hassle for our families, for our staff, and for our provider networks, who often are caught in the middle of this. We also look at the total cost of keeping those children enrolled, because we have retroactive eligibility back to 90 days. So we're paying for a lot of this cost already. So I think a big element was we were able to look at the data and say express lane redeterminations made a lot of sense based on the data. And we looked and said, can we act quickly and qualify or meet those incentive timelines. And I'm excited that the team we had was able to look at the data, find a way to act quickly, and then implement a redetermination program taking our SNAP and TANF data. I think it really does show the transition we need to make collectively in South Carolina and I think in other states about looking at the data, understanding what we're doing and why we're doing it, and making decisions that are highly data-driven. As a result of what I believe is a real success, we've now redetermined and re-enrolled about 80,000 kids since April 1st, averaging about 9,000 a month, which is about in line with what we would have expected. We then move forward to look at how do we take the remaining kids that we know are in the SNAP and TANF programs and look at an Express Lane enrollment program in a way that's fiscally responsible and that the state can afford. So we proposed in our budget, in our governor's executive budget was released last week, and she supported our efforts to move forward in the next fiscal year with Express Lane enrollment. And again, it makes sense, it is administratively prudent, and it provides access to coverage for those in the most need. We also believe it's a very important step in preparing for 2014 in the Medicaid expansion that is in the current law, is it gives us experience enrolling large numbers of people at one time. We expect somewhere between 70 and 80,000 kids exist at any given time in the SNAP and TANF roles. And it prepares our provider communities, our community partners, for the experience of how do we take these people into the program, get them the coverage, get them the benefits, and ensure that they start utilizing services. So we're looking forward to that. We are entering our legislative session in the budget process, but we're hopeful that we'll have the opportunity to extend, as I think the research has shown, many of the states continue to extend their programs as we look forward to 2014. We heard a lot about many of the states that are undertaking eligibility enrollment and other technology changes that are going to be both required, helpful, and really made possible through CMS's enhanced funding in the eligibility enrollment systems. But as probably more a technologist than definitely a Medicaid person, the technology isn't a silver bullet alone. What I see and what I encourage both my supervisors, our frontline staff, and other states as I talk with them is we've got to look at process improvement. So when we look at Express Lane eligibility, it's not just the technological ability to make a match and stop there and make the enrollment decision. It's what do we need to do next? And how, more importantly, do the processes and work that our state staff and our community partners do to make sure that the next steps are taken. We move out of the way the paper processes. We move out of the way sort of the requirements to check the boxes, and we have to move to the forefront a set of processes that ensure not just access to care, not just access to the coverage, but utilization of the services. So as we look forward, we look at the benefits and the opportunities of replacing our aging mainframe eligibility system as critical to the more important goal of process improvement. So how do we look at the whole process? How do we streamline those processes? And how do we take technology and measurement-driven outcomes as important goals in that effort? And I think in really summarizing that, I think that Cindy's example of the Lopez family is a great success story. How do we bring those success stories across the board? How do we ensure and start to measure and move our discussion beyond where we've had a lot of great success in bringing coverage? We need to continue that discussion. That's not going to stop. But I think it's time for us to move towards how do we measure the utilization? Once we give access to coverage, and then what are the outcomes? to building healthier communities. And that is our next step, is a broad community, because when I talk with pediatricians, our practices, we ask the question of, if we are able to cover and get access to this large population in your community, are you ready to absorb them? How do we start to understand how the healthcare access leads to healthier communities? So we're very excited in South Carolina. We are absolutely thrilled about the opportunity to be both here talking with you, but also really on behalf of the citizens to earn the bonus that shows we're taking the steps in the right direction. And we look forward to continuing those steps, really focused on health outcomes and the changes that we can make in the community level as we move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Diane.
That's what I was like. Normally, I'm a little bit louder. Okay, when I have a microphone in front of me. Thank you very much. Where was I? So, saying that we definitely cannot take all the credit, but it's true that I am committed in trying to find that remaining little kids and big kids, too, because I think we need to always remember that it's also the young adults or the older children that's also part of the group that we're trying to reach. So you have a wonderful report. So I want to also echo the thank you to the Kaiser and Georgetown. So thank you very much. And thank you very much for the opportunity for being here. So you're going to spend a great time looking at this wonderful report. So I'm not going to spend time giving the details of the policies we implemented or did not implement in Massachusetts. But I want to give you a little bit of flavor of the community work that has happened in Massachusetts. And I think I want to start us off by really putting out there the message that we can do it. Okay? So again, we can do it. We did it in Massachusetts. We did it for kids. Tricia already mentioned the number. 99.5% is the result. This is really the representation of the number of kids we were able to reach in Massachusetts. And I think I want to share a little bit of you this morning what are some of the ingredients to how we were able to accomplish that. So the secret to success, I think, is that recipe that your grandma keep for herself. Just kidding. Other states already using it. So it's not that secret anymore. But I want to start by saying that in Massachusetts, we had a top-down and bottom-up approach. So it was very important to have a broad awareness campaign. It was very important to involve the paid media, earned media, advertising, the systems in place that we were able to accomplish in Massachusetts, the policies that we were able to advance. But also, it's really the bottom up. And what I mean by that is really the community, is that people are working on their on different workplaces. People are living in different neighborhoods. People belong to different community groups. People go to church, synagogues, go to mosques. They take their kids to schools. They are really everywhere. And I think we cannot miss that important piece that is people really helping other people to connect to health insurance, but also to care. Thank you for that point. I think it is important to remember that having an insurance card does not always translate into accessing coverage. And I think in Massachusetts, the role of community-based organizations in helping people to navigate this system really, really, really worked. Okay? And it's important to remember that in Massachusetts, we have a very diverse group of individuals. So each community really did on their own way. I think each community has their magic way of reaching out to the people and helping them to access to to coverage. So it ranged from people setting up a table at a mall, people setting up a table at a church fair, going and giving presentations at a school, the western rural part of Massachusetts. Literally, this really happened. One of our community partners there placed a sticker on their local newspaper that said, "Are you uninsured? Give us a call." So it's very personable. It's really that one-on-one. So just pick up a phone and I'm going to help you. And that's really what we do at Healthcare for All. We have a helpline and we help them to sign up over the phone. So it's very easy for people. They don't need to miss a day out of work to go somewhere to enroll. They just call and we really help them to navigate that very complicated process to some people. Okay? And I was almost forgetting that another great way that this bottom-up also worked was really working with the local ethnic media. I myself have been going to several radio to target the Brazilian community. Have been doing this work for 5 years, so I was able to witness really the successes that Massachusetts had. And one of the key successes for Healthcare for All was really me going out to the radio program and talking to the Brazilian community. The Brazilian community was key in Massachusetts. I will be bold and say Portuguese is the second most spoken language in Massachusetts, then Spanish. A lot of people don't believe me on that, but I can prove. And one of the ways that I really realized, and I'm Brazilian, but I also realized the large community that was there, is that every time I would go to the radio and I would give the phone number, our phones would not stop ringing, literally, would not stop ringing. There is one thing that I want to say, don't do it. Don't give your cell phone on the radio. What was I thinking? Anyways, all to get those kids enrolled. And I think that one secret ingredient is creativity. I really encourage creativity. I think being creative on these tough economic times really help us a lot. And I can give you two quick examples that we did at Healthcare for All. So one was a phone-a-thon where we just put it at pressure time. We told families, you have one day to enroll your kids. So on September 29th, people were like crazy calling, thinking that that was the only day. I felt bad. But honestly, it worked. We had 405 people calling us in one day, thinking, can I enroll today? And the second thing was a fun challenge that we did in Massachusetts. We challenged all the states to really increase their efforts and enroll as much kids as possible in 1 month. We had a goal of 500 kids. We enrolled 1,479. Great. So, creativity. The second ingredient is the essence, right? So, we had the approach, and now what's the essence? The essence of our work is one very simple and complex word, partnership. Okay? And we were really successful because of the relationships and the partnerships that we were able to develop and maintain in Massachusetts. And one very special partnership is the relationship between the state and the community-based organizations. So first of all, the state provided funding to 51 grants to help them to enroll. So that alone is big and key. Why? Because you are maximizing your potential to really enroll people, but also to be able to provide culturally appropriated service in different multiple languages that the state alone couldn't do, really. Okay? And it's important that it's very clear to us in Massachusetts that it is a two-way street. I think that's this notion of two-way street works in many parts of our lives, right? You give something, you receive something, it's like always an exchange. And the fact that the state is providing the support to community-based organizations and the community-based organizations providing the support back to the state has been very, very important. And one thing that the state does for Our organizations is providing training and updates on a quarterly basis. So we're always aware what are the policy and operations changes that are happening on a regular basis. But also, we serve as their canary. Am I saying that right? Canary or canary? What's the bird?
Canary.
That bird. Which means we are always spotting glitches and letting the state knows what's working, what's not working. It also goes to that level of partnership. We proofread and provide edits to documents before the state sends out. So big, big partnership there. And the other precious partnership is with the diverse stakeholders that really allowed us to accomplish this amazing number of 99.5%, which are the other partners that A, are doing similar work that we're doing in Healthcare for All, and B, are also just helping to get the word out. I think Cindy mentioned, you know, the old-fashioned outreach, making sure that people get the information. So working with the doctor's office, so they know which options are available to people, working with the churches, working with the schools, working with employers, so really working with a variety of people and building this strong stakeholder partnership. Has really been integral to our success. And third and final ingredient is really the catalyst, which is money. We need substantial financial resources to do this work. And we were able to do this work in Massachusetts because we received state money, federal money, and also funding from private foundations that supported this work. So this work is not for free. But it is important and it pays off. So I think it's important to remember that Massachusetts is doing so well, but if we stop investing, we're just going to go backwards, and we do not want that, right? And I think it's important to really reiterate that all states need the money to continue the work that they are doing, and we heard that many states are doing great work as well. So now, moving forward, the work doesn't stop once you get them enrolled. And what we learned in Massachusetts is that it's hard work getting kids enrolled, even harder keeping them enrolled. So we need the systems in place in order to be able to do that. And I want to thank Cindy for approving our waiver at Massachusetts. It's going to just help us to really do just more greater good things when it comes to coverage retention. So that's going to be really key for us. So thank you so much. And we just need to continue to involve people in that process of coverage retention as well. Okay. And to conclude, I will just again say we need to have systems that works. We'll agree that we need to have technology in place and use technology in a smart way. But it really comes down to people. If we don't have that one-on-one conversation that happens over and over and over and over, it's going to be hard. People love systems. I'm just talking people in the community, absolutely loves and appreciate. But when you give them a 17-page form for them to fill out, it's like, ah, I don't think I can do that. So I think we really need to help them to navigate that particular process. And we embraced in Massachusetts three words and encouraged that we continue to embrace that. So one is choice. We made the choice to really provide services to kids and coverage to kids. Commitment to do the work and creativity, as I mentioned before. And if I can just be a little bit bold, if you are able, can you please stand up if you are an advocate? Can you please stand up if you are a policy analyst? Can you please stand up if you're part, remain standing, I forgot about that little direction. Can you please stand up if you're a member of the media or the ethnic media? Can you please stand up if you care about children's health? I just want to see everybody standing, if you may, to say that it's because of people like you that we were able to do the work we did in Massachusetts. And we need people like you to really do the work that we need to continue to do and to get where we all want to get. So thank you so much, and thank you for playing this standing up.
I think there should be no doubt that she's going to get to 100%. And I think this clearly demonstrates that while we can have lots of statistics in the report about steps and processes and changes in income levels and eligibility, that what really matters is what happens on the ground and the leadership that the people on this panel and others out there are really demonstrating in their commitment to getting kids covered. So with that, we would love to have you ask the panel more about what they do and how they do it, or about some of the findings from the survey. If you would please raise your hand so that our people with mics can find you, and then identify your affiliation and name so that the panel knows who's asking them a question. And if you prefer to direct your question to a particular panelist, please do so.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thanks for a great event. My name is Josh Rovner. I'm with the National Assembly on School-Based Healthcare, but I'll try not to make it too selfish a question. I'm curious about the experience from Massachusetts. Now that we have so many kids enrolled, I'm curious about Act Two. Like, how well is it working to save money on the back end? How well are you keeping kids out of emergency rooms and getting the primary care that the kids need? I mean, my selfishness in this is that school-based healthcare is a great way to get kids to the doctors and nurse practitioners. But is it working in Massachusetts now that they're enrolled and have eligibility? Are they getting the care that they need? And is the cost savings emerging?
Great question. So two things. One is that as far as the cost savings, I just want to say that we are now, so we're moving towards phase two. So we had phase one back in 2006 with our own health reform. And right now we are in the process of really working towards another reform, which is around payment reform. So that's where we really hope to save costs there. As far as the school-based healthcare, school-based health centers, I just wanted to say that we also partner with them and we value the work. It is always a challenge for the schools. They don't have enough staff to be able to even the nurses to be able to provide the immediate care that kids need. And I don't think I have an answer to the full question, but I think it is a challenge that we also have in Massachusetts. But I think the important thing is that we have two things on the radar. One is this cost. We just need to do something about cost because it's not sustainable. And number two, again, going back to my point of partnership, understanding that other places really play a crucial role in making sure that kids are connected to care. And finally, the role of community-based organizations in general. I think we don't only really provide the enrollment assistance and make sure they have a card, but at Healthcare for All, for example, they're constantly calling us and really asking for help to connect them to a provider, to connect them to a dentist. It's very hard to find dentists. There's sometimes a wait list to find, but I think we are trying to do that better and better, but it's a challenge.
Good morning. Marisa Scala Foley with the Administration on Aging. First of all, thank you. This briefing has been terrific. My question is primarily for the study authors, but also I'd love to hear from the states on this. And while I know your focus was primarily on children and low-income adults, I wondered if you got any sense from your survey of the extent to which any of these administrative simplifications have been extended to other populations, such as older adults or younger adults with disabilities.
I mean, in this study, we really focused on the non-disabled and non-elderly populations, and most of the folks we were speaking to in the state administrations really deal solely with those populations. So I don't feel like we have a good sense of that from this work. We do have a number of other efforts underway in the foundation exploring what's going on for those populations, so I'd be happy to connect afterwards and direct you to some people and resources that can help you.
Speaking on the state of South Carolina's behalf, I think we really see the simplifications, not necessarily the policy, but as we apply technology, as we apply process improvement, we're lockstep in with our long-term care, our other programs. So we really see some of the opportunities here that are driven through the CHIPRA programs as ways to pilot or test things that are good for all the populations. So I see that as how it'll play out in our state.
Thank you. Next question.
Mary Mascara with Government Health IT and Healthcare Finance News. I'm especially interested to hear from the states. As you said, Ms. Leal, that you have to keep on investing. We can't stop now. Have the states prepared or made some type of thinking ahead if during the Supreme Court arguments, when the Supreme Court decides about the health reform law, if they decide that the Medicaid provision is will not stand, will how will that affect states? Because you're so far invested already in preparing to cover a whole lot more people, and especially with so much funding coming from CMS federal funds to help with your simplification and with your systems, how will you go forward? Have you prepared, or has the legislature talked about it? Because that could happen mid-year, may have a real effect.
Let me see if I understood your question. If you're prepared to take on the kids, or you're talking about if the funds are not there after?
Yeah, if the funds are not there, or if there is not the drive because that provision has been struck down from the law, have you thought about what states will do, or will you continue as you have been anyways because you're so far into it that you're just going to keep going? Because it's in the state's best interest.
Sure. So first of all, this issue about the financial issue, it's already here. So we as advocates are also advocating for funding for our administration. So just recently, we had a meeting with the Office of Medicaid in making a decision that one of the coalitions that Healthcare for All runs, the ACT coalition, that we wanted to really advocate for more funding so then they can pay for administrative staff. So I think staff is always an issue. How can you really make sure that you can, on the back end, be processing all these cases, right? And the other thing is, I think we already have proven that we are committed no matter what. We have made this commitment to help kids for so many years. We already expanded our coverage. So many years back, we have 300% of the federal poverty level. So there is a commitment. But there is a shift now, which, as I mentioned before, that we need to be creative and smarter on keeping kids covered. And I think we can have some savings there. We haven't been able to quantify how much would that mean, but we know there's tons of notices that MassHealth is our Medicaid and CHIP, really, in Massachusetts. There's tons of notices that they send to families when they fall off of coverage, despite the fact that they're still eligible. So I think it's really a shift now on we got this far, we were able to enroll these kids. Now the next step for us is really making sure they keep covered and we will find a way. We are going to be faced with a challenge next year because the 51 grantees are no longer going to be receiving state dollars. So this really is a challenge for us, but I guess the commitment's going to help us to hold on onto this rough tide and just, hope for better days.
And Trish, you had a comment. And then
yeah,
John.
None of the lower courts have struck down the Medicaid expansion. And so I think it's unlikely, although I'm not a constitutional lawyer, that will happen. But I will say that
states have, this is, the transformation of technology is long overdue. States have been putting Band-Aids on these old, decades-old mainframe systems to get by, and they are crippled in having the kind of data they need to make sure that their programs work more efficiently and are hitting the mark. So I would hope, even in, you know, those, that outside chance that something might happen, that we would continue to see the investment in technology. These programs are not going to go away. They've been highly successful. States have been, you know, making incremental gains along the way, and they need the technology to back them up, and I hope that the federal support will stay there no matter what.
John, and then Deanna, could you turn your mic off?
Yeah. Great. So I was going to talk about kids' coverage and then the systems, but I'll continue what Tricia started. The systems we have in South Carolina, I think in many states, do need updated, and updating them will make for more efficient government. So regardless of how things go, as long as the enhanced funding and the alignment that eligibility systems and MMIS or the claims processing systems are funded in the same ways as what CMS did last year, there's no reason in our state, and I think in many states, we would stop that movement forward, because it's good for process improvement and actually very good for improved and more efficient government. In South Carolina, the programs that I spoke about, and including our Express Lane efforts that we have in next year's proposed budgets, are to cover those people already eligible but not yet enrolled under our current laws. So currently, we're able to run these programs to these coverage levels, and we've been actually instructed in legislation to use technology to do this. So the way that we've approached this is there's a lot of uncertainty, but the things that we're doing are either based on the current laws and technologically good under all circumstances. And I would hope many states see things in a similar way.
Samantha, I'm not going to make Cindy comment. She's the one.
I just want to echo John's comment. I think you know, all of us who conducted the interviews for the survey this year would come away with the feeling that the improvements we were seeing, especially on the technology front and the decision to take up the enhanced funding, was just as much about improving current program operations as it had to, and not necessarily so focused with the goal on preparing for reform. As Tricia mentioned, I think states have long been frustrated with the limitations of their current systems. And John, frankly, I think many states would be jealous that you have access to the kind of performance data now that enabled you to identify where you were having problems and the types of policies you could put into place to solve those problems. So I think a lot of the technology improvements picked up in the survey, again, are about states dealing with current program operations and trying to use scarce resources as best as possible, and using the availability of the federal funds to support those efforts.
Okay, next question.
Hi. I'm Kathy Kumerker from the Association for Community Affiliated Plans, which is a member organization of safety net health plans across the nation. And first, I wanted to thank you again for, as many other did, for a wonderful report and for many, many years of wonderful reports. But I also wanted to follow up on a comment that one of the panelists made, and then one of the earlier questions, about some of the simplification efforts that are available now for children but that aren't really available for adults, and in particular the issue of continuous eligibility. And you know, we can also see from the report that 12-month renewal periods are very helpful, but they clearly have not managed to make a full dent in the amount of churning that goes on. While I think there are a number of groups and organizations that think we can get to continuous eligibility without an additional statutory change, if that is something that is required, I'd be interested to hear from the panel about what kinds of arguments do you think would help to sway legislators on a state or national level that this is important and that continuous eligibility for everyone on Medicaid and CHIP is an important factor in a way to make the programs run well. Thank you.
Trish.
We can't measure quality of health care and outcomes unless we keep people continuously enrolled. And even in states like Utah, the legislature's talking about 12-month continuous eligibility. And that's being prompted to a large extent by the insurers who are pressured to produce proof that the dollars invested in what they do matter. So I think that's the most persuasive argument. The proposed rules for the Medicaid expansion do take, you know, a little step forward by allowing states to look at whether a change impacts eligibility overall going forward toward the end of the year. Not quite as far as I would have liked to have seen it go, but I hope that we'll see more states realizing the importance of aligning all of those policy options and doing what New York did and seeking waiver approval to do that. But I do think the quality of care and the measurement is a key piece there.
Okay, back here.
Can I add one quick thing? I think in Massachusetts, we really have seen that kids and parents really go together. Health reform, we had it was mandate for adults to seek coverage, but not kids. But we saw that that had a reflection on kids really accessing coverage. So I think they're very integral. And in Massachusetts, we also have been, we believe that we should do programs for policies for adults as well. So our waiver, again, thank you, will also be for kids and adults. And the continuity of care is really important. And I think that, again, is the combination of what you can do at the grassroots level and also, you know, policies like the Express Lane renewal, for example, that can really make a difference. I just want to quickly say that in Massachusetts, we did this effort of providing magnets to remind families that they need to open their mail, because I think this is a big problem. You get a mail with a very important open. If you're already with a lot of problems in your life, you're going to be like, oh my gosh, one more problem, I'm not going to open. And then also bookmarks that help families to learn or be aware of some tips that they can do to make sure they keep coverage. And that's for adults and kids. So I think, we, you know, there are some efforts out there that can just help us move in that direction.
Okay, next question.
Linda Homburg from the Maternal and Child Health Bureau. And Cindy, I want to thank you for pointing out the role the Title V Maternal and Child Health Agency played in Iowa in getting the family coverage and enrollment. And I'd like to hear from the other panelists the role that Title V has played in terms of outreach and working with, you know, women and children, not only to get enrolled in Medicaid and CHIP, but also in quality improvement, in providing medical homes, and in, you know, outreach services. Thank you.
John.
I think the coverage available, particularly with regard to pregnant women and a number of other programs, and when we talk about what it means to look at health outcomes, we believe that starting as early in the pregnancy and ensuring a healthy pregnancy, being able to get simplification with regard to enrolling the children of enrolled mothers, and then looking at that immediate care is what's going to guide to our overall outcomes. And again, we've got a number of, I think, more medically focused, but programs. We have a birth outcomes initiative, which we're looking at preterm deliveries on our in our OBGYN communities. And we're also looking at a program that's called ESPERT that looks to identify potential problems or issues with substance abuse or other problems within the household to lead to the outcomes for healthy delivery and then healthy children. So we really do believe that it's a continuum of care that really starts with the pregnancy, and I think those programs have enabled us to think about it that way.
Okay, question over here.
Kuttner Hudson Institute. Question for John Supra. As a technologist, you've got 23 months to jump 23 years in systems. Give us a stronger and more detailed sense of what it is that you need to accomplish in that period of time.
Great. So putting on the technologist hat, I'm going to talk about this, I think, in three ways. One is my background and experience is primarily driven in building large web-based applications, which in general are built in the three terms that I use with my team are agile, iterative, and incremental. And what I mean by that is we need to move a lot more quickly. We need to be able to make decisions and start implementing technology and get it mostly right and understand that we can iterate over it. I've looked at a lot of both ideas, both process as well as technology that has existed in our department for many years. But what they are big reports that could never get implemented from the beginning to end. And if we started at the beginning, the whole world would change by the time we got to the end. So that leads us to that last term, incremental. So the plan that we proposed, and I'm excited that CMS, I think in this environment of change, had adopted or allowed us to pursue is an incremental approach to focus on those things that we absolutely need to meet the requirements of 2014, put those things that are nice to haves that we would love to have, would have had, but are not required to meet October 2013, January 2014, choose the date, put those into 2015, and then to take the things that are most important in the very short term and start delivering them. So under the enhanced funding, we've already made a stride with a pilot in one of our largest offices for electronic document management, which will be one component of the bigger system. We need to replace the eligibility rules engine, a separate phase. And in our APD, we proposed, I believe, 6 or 7 phases to meet those requirements. And I think the real key for myself and other technology side leaders is what is really minimally required, what's your long-term plan, and how do you move toward that, knowing we can't do everything today. And one of the things that I talk a lot about in the iterative piece is if we really have this plan that requires 3 iterations, but other things distract us, become priorities, and we only do this first iteration, does it make the lives of our families, our staff, or our provider communities better? And if so, it's worth doing it, and let's get it out there. So that's a transformation that I think is very much tied to how we think about technology, how we think about its implementation in the Medicaid program, and I think in government in a broader sense, and is really continues to be driven by what are the process outcomes that we need to deliver.
Okay. One back here and then
if,
here.
If I can just quickly add to that, I think John is the perfect advertisement, I think, for the direction that we think states need to be going in, and that our new regulations and our procedures are really geared towards helping states do just that, which is take things in chunks, do what you do well, exchange and share chunks across states. We do not want to pay for, nor do states need to pay for, something that, you know, 6 other states have already done. If that can be lessons learned or just, you know, stolen from one to the other. We've created an IT platform that for states and have actually required them to deposit their artifacts on that platform, and for other states to be able to use it and pick and choose. So the modular approach, the incremental approach, the continuing improvement approach, I think is very much sensible, because we have had many decades of major projects going on and not always to successful completion.
Okay, question here.
Bill Galowitz with Kaiser Health News. 2 questions. I wonder if Cindy and Tricia could address. CMS has talked about there's been a fair amount of progress in enrolling kids who are qualified but are not enrolled in Medicaid. Has there been much improvement as far as adults who basically would qualify for Medicaid but not enrolled? And I guess the second question, more if you could talk about, there's been a lot of staffing cutbacks in a lot of state capitals. If you may have heard, there was a big lawsuit filed in Connecticut where the against the Medicaid agency, saying these staffing cutbacks have led to making it so it's harder to sign kids up for Medicaid. Have you seen this around the country, and can you talk about it?
Cindy first.
There hasn't been as much data available and looking at what's gone on with adults, but we have seen generally that there's been improvements in adults following along. I think the chart that Tricia showed is that we have increasingly seen over the years states picking up on the kind of proven advances that they've done in for children and saying, well, wait a minute. Families are families. We should apply it to the parents, and then thinking more broadly to the extent that they're covering other populations of adults beyond parents and kids. So I think the progress for eligible but unenrolled adults is lagging behind kids, but it is moving in exactly the same direction. And as John points to, you know, you develop a system, you develop a process improvement. You know, there is no reason, and there's lots of reasons otherwise, you don't silo it. You think about your process improvement across your populations. It's certainly how we're looking at it. We think that's increasingly how states are looking at it. And certainly for 2014, a broader approach is required. You know, staffing cutbacks are real issues for states. They're facing just an extraordinary amount of pressure, and administrative costs tend to be thin already in the Medicaid program, but getting thinner because of budget constraints. It does cause issues. It also stimulates creativity. I think Dana has talked about creativity as one of her magic ingredients. You know, what some of the improvements, for example, that Louisiana has done over the years that has really gotten their procedural denials on renewals to nearly zero. Literally nearly zero, and not just for kids, have lessened the workload on their staff, on their local staff. So, at some point it seemed like, well, maybe it takes more work to really make sure the case doesn't get closed. In fact, it turned out that the procedures that they adopted, some of which were technology-based, but some of them were very hands-on in terms of contacting families, in the end turned out to be savers in terms of administrative expenditures. So I think it does push a lot of states to be looking for new ways of moving forward.
Question here.
I think Cindy's right. I was going to mention Louisiana as well, because we've seen graphs that show the increasing caseloads and the staff level remaining relatively flat and even taking a dip in the past couple of years. If you look out over a decade, the diminishing administrative resources were cited virtually in every state. We know that they're strained, and so whether it's just staffing or freezing vacant positions as people leave, doing early retirement buyouts, there's no doubt that this has had an impact not only on the manpower that's available, but also on the historic knowledge of how the agency runs and how they do things. I think it's a stressful time for Medicaid eligibility staff. But you see these states stepping up. I think it's important that we continue to record some of the progress of the innovator states so other states can look at that and go, ah, if they can do that, I can do that. And when you particularly see states like Utah has a very advanced system, Oklahoma's not was one of those states that had less than 200% in child eligibility, but they've got the first online, real-time, automated system, and that states need to keep borrowing those proven practices from one another. But no doubt, it's a tough time for eligibility.
I'm aware we're out of time, but we're going to take two more questions, one here and one in the back, and ask the panel to keep their answers brief.
Hi, I'm Doug Trapp with American Medical News. There's been a lot of talk from governors and state leaders about the cost of Medicaid and CHIP coverage, about the sustainability of it, a lot of worries on their part. I'm wondering if you guys could talk about the value, what states and the federal government are getting for their money, their Medicaid and CHIP dollars. We heard one story earlier, but could you talk about it in a bigger sense?
Cindy?
Well, there's, I think, multiple ways to measure the value of the investment in healthcare coverage. And, I think most of us choose to have healthcare coverage because we understand the value in that personal sense to ourselves, our family members, and our children. And I think, there's the idea of coverage, of course, is are we connecting people to good care? Surveys in the Medicaid program, we just finished a survey that showed that 93% of parents with kids enrolled in Medicaid and CHIP were satisfied with the care that their kid were getting. Almost two-thirds of them were very satisfied. 9 out of 10 had no problems finding a doctor. We know we've got some issues in some parts of the country and for some specialties, and we need to work on that. But if you look at Marilyn, who was able to get glasses and see in the classroom better than she was the day before she was enrolled in the Medicaid program, that gives you just a beginning glimpse of what can be accomplished. But I think, as John said, what increasingly states are focusing on, and certainly we're working with many of them in this area, is let's get past the issue of getting people covered and churning. Let's keep people insured, and then let's focus on making sure they get good quality care and that we're working on improving that care as much as possible so that we can provide better health, better quality, and do so at lower costs.
Okay. And last question at the back.
Hi, my name is Lori Albin-Havens. I'm with the American Speech, Language, and Hearing Association. And interestingly, you just made the comment about providers and difficulty with access to providers. And you had made the comment, Mr. Supra, about in South Carolina, about you go to the physicians and say, are you ready to absorb those people? And that's my question. I appreciate greatly the enrollment factor, but then what are you doing to make, you know, for the providers or help the providers to become available to provide those services?
John.
Yeah, I think it really starts in our state as we look at expanding this access and doing these express lane activities, starting to talk with the communities. So it involves the providers. I think the question earlier about the health systems within the schools, alternatives to traditional providers. How can the community partners that are represented provide some of that? So as we look forward to health care in the broadest sense in health outcomes as a healthy community, I think it's the challenge to all of us to rethink what that exactly looks like. It means our providers become a broader group of people, and they provide different pieces of the health care puzzle. I think that it means communities as a whole figure out what works in local communities, which may be different in different communities, and it becomes our responsibility to look at how do we measure these things to ensure that we are getting the value for the dollars being put into the programs. So as we've moved forward on the coverage and made good progress, as we move forward in South Carolina, and I think many states are, we're thinking about that family of care as we put these policy changes, these programs in place.
I think we've clearly seen today that coverage starts with enrollment, but it doesn't stop there. It really translates into much more on the ground. I think we've also seen that it takes real leadership, but that as Diana said, we can do it, and that clearly everyone can take away many messages of how to get there, but it certainly takes people like the panel and the researchers we have here to keep us going. So I want to thank everyone for coming, and especially our panel for being with us.